Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. Wherever writing and knowledge meet, there the communication of scholarship is taking place, and there too we at Scholarly Communication have our place. I'm Daniel Shea, your host for today's interview with Ken Hyland, Professor of Applied Linguistics in Education at the University of East Anglia. His book, Second Language Writing, was published in a second edition by Cambridge University Press in 2019. Ken Hyland doesn't need an introduction. If your own research has taken you even briefly into the fields of sociolinguistics, applied linguistics, corpus linguistics, genre studies, discourse analysis, if your job brings you in or near the context of EAL, English for Speakers of Additional Languages, EAP, English for Academic Purposes, if your interests so much as touch upon the ethnography of the university and all the rest of academia, well, if any of that describes your work, then you are sure to have had in hand recently an article or book where at the back in the references, one name for certain fills a page, or more. Ken Hyland. Ken Hyland has written over 250 articles and nearly 30 books. His books go into second and more editions. His articles get published and then get collected. Ken Hyland's findings and his interpretations and his views count to many fields. His book, Disciplinary Discourses, makes plain that the writing we academics do, that task and technology that really sets up, or if you will, institutes the entire academic project, the book makes plain that our writing is, despite what many disciplinary experts say to the contrary, content knowledge. But our writing is much more, too, because academic writing is the enacting of power relationships. It is the drawing of in-group and out-group boundaries. It is the making of appeals for credibility amongst fellow researchers. Academic texts are, when viewed for what they do, just as shaping of academia as are the funding structures, the departmental structures, the very building structures. In fact, writing has its influence all over all of these, and is also itself a structure of the academic world. And Ken Hyland is, too, the founding editor of the Journal for English of Academic Purposes, a hub of research in this burgeoning field, and he has served as co-editor at Applied Linguistics, yet another major journal in the fields of linguistics and the English language. It is clear, Ken Hyland is an extraordinarily productive and influential researcher. However, it is also clear that Ken Hyland is an experienced and highly effective teacher. He has taught in Asia, Africa, and Europe. He was previously a professor in London and in Hong Kong, and today, besides serving as a visiting professor in Jilin University, China, Ken is currently professor of applied linguistics in education at the University of East Anglia. So it is clear Ken Hyland is a prominent practitioner and researcher all around, but he certainly enjoys great prominence in second language writing, the topic of today's book, which has also gone in this second edition. As Ken Hyland so vividly puts it in the preface, the first edition of this book appeared back in 2003. That seems, and indeed is, a long time ago, the same year as the invasion of Iraq and the release of the final film of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Those events seem historically remote now, and second language writing has moved on too. Yes, a lot has moved on, in the field and elsewhere, but Ken Hyland has always been at the forefront of the field, and was then, with the first edition of second language writing, and is now again with this thoroughly updated edition of second language writing. The book is like an airport. Picture London Heathrow, before the pandemic, of course. From Heathrow, you can get anywhere in the world, right? Well, from the book Second Language Writing, you can get anywhere in the world of its title. You want to teach better reading skills or teach better writing skills, you can get there. You want to create better materials for your courses, you can get there. You want to give better assignments, provide better feedback to your students, you can get there. You believe you have an idea for your own research project, well, there you can get too. Second language writing is your point of departure and, to stay in the metaphor, Ken Hyland, your pilot and guide. The premise of the book is this. A good teacher is a reflective teacher. The reader encounters throughout the book reflections, small boxes that prompt thinking by putting questions to the reader about the topic at hand. This, you might say, is teacher training and researcher training at a distance. Every chapter ends on discussions, which prompt more thinking, but from a wider perspective, and the reader finds there, at the ends of the chapters, two valuable appendices full of examples, as well as on-point recommended readings, in each case some five or eight essential titles. As all great books about practical subject matter, second language writing has theory, but the unique thing here is that it's the book's readers who make the theory themselves, and that's called their thinking. The best of teachers will step forth from second language writing, and many an excellent future researcher will take the confidence to get out there and do it from the pages of second language writing. So let's begin today's episode. Ken Hyland and second language writing. Ken, welcome to Scholarly Communication.
Thank you, Daniel, and thanks for that over-generous introduction. I certainly don't deserve all those plaudits, and I think you've been very generous about the book as well. I mean, I wanted to write a practical, accessible, comprehensive kind of introduction for teachers and researchers who may wanted to know a bit more about the topic. I don't see it as a straight ahead teacher training textbook. I was trying to inform myself as much as readers when I wrote it. You know, I wanted to update my knowledge, particularly in areas like technology and assessment, which I don't usually publish on, and in fact it was interesting to see how teachers are using Facebook, Twitter and wikis for collaborative writing, and so there's a lot of sites out there that were new to me. As you say, I was trying to engage readers through reflection and activities and thinking about what I was writing about, lots of examples, screenshots, the kinds of materials that that were out there, and I remember when I wrote the first edition, I met Alistair Cumming at a TESOL conference, and he'd reviewed it and said, well, where are the teachers' voices? And so I went back and I put a lot of quotes in, because I think, I wanted to understand how teachers felt about a lot of this stuff as well, and the problems that they were having and what they were doing in their classes. So, it's the book is a labor of love, really. The other reason I wrote it was to kind of offer a credible alternative to the many texts that follow a process approach to teaching. I wanted to, put genre in people's faces to present a way of understanding writing that involves both process and genre. So there's a very good book by Ferris and Hedgecock that you may know that comes closest to this book, but it does omit key issues like technology, and it has a very strong process-oriented approach to writing and a kind of US composition class orientation. And I was trying to move away from that because I think perhaps non-Americans might find that a bit alien, because it's really only in the US where there are dedicated credit-bearing composition classes. You know, where writing classes exist around the world, they're usually more EAP or ESP oriented for students. So it's really an introduction with attitude, really. I want a clear stance that writing involves both composing skills and knowledge about texts and about the contexts that surround texts, which include the readers. So it was a mission, really.
Well, I would say in many ways a mission accomplished, and also what really stuck out for me was how you did, as you just say, stake the ground very clearly in the opening chapter with on writing and teaching writing. You go through six different focuses that have traditionally, let's say, caught readers' attentions or be in the way that teachers normally go about teaching writing. You mentioned one process, what being one of the dominant ones, clearly since at least the 1980s and very much in America. You propose certainly genre, as you're saying, as well as being an important point. The others that come up there about expression, textual function, structure, or even content, could you maybe just in a word or two give us a mix of these and what leads us then to genre as being such a useful approach?
I think chapter one, you know, I wanted to be as fair as possible, but it a lot of those approaches are now historical. The functional approach, was very big in ESP in the 60s and 70s. The functions that particular structures and patterns of language were expressing. The expressivist, I think, is rooted in early American process models before Flower and Hayes and Barita and Scudamalia brought the cognitive aspects into it and made it a more a kind of more academically respectable scientific model. The idea that writers were trying to express personal meanings, their creativity. I mean, that still exists in process to a large extent through the idea of voice and self-expression, but it's become more sophisticated now in the more cognitivist model. I think. I mean, you mentioned that process is dominant. I think that's probably true now since the 1980s, certainly in the US. Around the world, it might be the case that a lot of writing classes are disguised grammar classes, that they're there to get students to practice particular grammar structures. And grammar is important. I mean, you can't write without grammar, but it's not everything. And just arranging the words and the clauses, putting all these in the right order isn't really enough. You can't say exactly what you want to say by just, you know, arranging the grammar. I think this has been a dominant classroom approach. I mean, I've taught in many countries, and this has been very popular. And it spills over into all kinds of things like, you know, error correction and the need to for students to demonstrate competence in grammar. But accuracy, you know, is only one feature of good writing. It doesn't really on its own make communication. This is how lawyers make their money. They, you know, the most explicitly written contracts and legal documents, you know, are perfectly grammatical, but they can still be picked apart and given different interpretations. So we have to think about you know, purpose, context, and readers. You know, the goal of writing teachers can't be just training students in accuracy, because all text include what writers assume their readers will know and how they're going to use the text. So the writer's problem is not to make everything explicit through, you know, setting things out with perfect grammar, but to make it explicit for particular readers, balancing what needs to be said against what can be assumed. And so we, you know, we need to consider discourse and genre, as you say. And that's the reason why, you know, the idea of genre has become so so important. I think it originally it came out of Australian primary schools, and Jim Martin and his colleagues found when they went into schools that the kids were writing science reports in the style of a narrative, of a story, because that was the only kind of text they'd been taught to write. So they identified the different genres that students were required to write in the primary school so that they could be more explicitly taught. The idea of genre really is that students need that supporting knowledge. You know, that they can't just learn to write by writing, by drafting and redrafting. They can't learn to write just by focusing on the grammatical product, but what it is that the text is trying to do. You know, what purpose is it trying to achieve for the writer, in what context? You know, how is it going to work with particular readers? So you know, I think that's where the importance of genre comes into language teaching. And it also, of course, tells us a lot about language, you know, and what people are trying to do with language.
And genre will make most people probably think of literary studies and drama and epic and so on. But of course, what you're describing as the genre movement in teaching writing, writing studies, or even second language writing, is clearly something much bigger, as you're making very clear. And I just want to maybe just pause on it for a moment in connection with this idea of process again. I mean, genre as itself is a thing that is a community. It's social, but it's also a thing that is, as you just stated, is linguistic. It's communication, and community and communication are clearly going together. So maybe to become less abstract, if you're in biology, biologists have a particular way of expressing themselves because they're talking about particular things, and they need to do particular things together with their research, through their publications, and so on and so forth. So that is their genre. It's kind of all-encompassing. And I suppose one of the things, I'm just going to throw this on top of that, and I'll give the floor to you. One of the things that's always kind of thrown me with the process approach is, I think anyone who's spent a fair amount of time writing knows that there's a process involved. And when I've looked at all the different models, I have the impression, the distinct impression, that things become more complicated by their distinctiveness, the parts in the process, the names, the diagrams, and so on, to a level that you start to wonder, okay, have we not made processes out of processes, epicircles and epicenters out of out of this larger thing?
I think, it's easy to fetishize the process. But process has obviously been important. You know, I think it has made teachers feel more professional about what they're doing. You know, here is a model of writing and of learning to write that comes with, serious cognitive credentials. So, you know, we take it for granted now that the writers have goals, that they plan extensively, that they revise. Often the revision is in the head before any text has been put down on paper. That this planning, drafting, and revising, and editing is often going on. It's recursive, of course, but it's often going on simultaneously. So. And this constant evaluation of what we write in this plan, write, plan loop that good writers use. I think a lot of ideas that are used by genre teachers also are going to come out of the process approach, brainstorming and outlining, drafting, feedback on drafts, and so on. I think one of the things that a genre teacher would object to very strongly, though, is the idea that originates in process. I'm not sure if people still follow it in process, is that that surface corrections, that the teacher doesn't intervene until the final editing stage. So the basic model is that the teacher gives the students a topic and then goes and stands in the corner while the students write it. So any language intervention comes at the end in the form of editing rather than at the beginning in terms of scaffolding. So language is not seen as a basic component of writing. This might be okay for, well-educated L1 students who come to class, an undergraduate class, with a good implicit knowledge of their language and familiarity, at least visual familiarity, with a lot of different genres that they've come across, but so that they can perhaps draw on that in writing. But a second language student is coming without those resources. And so a genre approach, which puts an emphasis on providing students with the linguistic and rhetorical resources to develop a particular kind of text, is in a better position. There's this discovery-based approach. You discover meaning while you're writing, doesn't make the language that students need explicit. So the students can only really discover the appropriate forms that they need in the teacher's feedback, and that comes at the end, so it's really too late. So the issue is really that all writing is not the same. It doesn't always depend on an ability to use universal context-independent revision and editing practices. Exam writing, isn't multi-drafted and it's time-constrained. A lot of academic and professional writing is often collaborative, So different writing involves different processes, and we're not always sure what those processes are, and the students don't often have the language that they need to do it. I think also, you know, as far as teachers are concerned, I wonder where this leaves teachers. In some ways, process models disempower the teacher, because this is a model of learning based on personal freedom, self-expression, learner responsibility. And all of this might be crushed by too much teacher intervention. So it's a hands-off approach. And because language and text organization tend to be added on to the end of the process as editing rather than as central resources for constructing meanings, as I've said, students don't have the way of seeing how, you know, different texts are written for particular purposes and audiences. So I think now a lot of process teachers will be aware of this and will be trying to front load the writing that they're getting students to do with the sort of structures that they need. But this idea of, you know, top-down purposes, you know, you're writing a report or an essay or a letter, requires different kinds of rhetorical decisions, is an important thing for students to learn.
And at one point in the book, you also talk about the different tasks that can be done by a teacher to help students learn precisely that, or even just writers generally. It doesn't have to just be students. And of course, one of the greater challenges is directly in that area that genre opens up for us, the idea of purposes, the idea of audience and community. And it's sort of a perennial problem, isn't it, for writers to get their readers, or then to somehow step back and see what they've written from their reader's perspective. I mean, this is, you know, only the best of writers sort of achieve that. And you bring in some great ideas on, you know, what might be done there. The areas of peer review, for example, are discussed in the book as a potential for, you know, a testing ground, if you like. I wonder what you could say a little bit more specifically about how peer review is useful, or writers groups generally.
Well, obviously, as you say, it provides an alternative audience. The whole idea of who am I writing this for? What do they know? What do they need to know? What rhetorical expectations do they have of the text? What do they believe? You know, are they going to disagree with me or agree with me? All these things are going to be impact the way that you write. And I think, you know, this the idea of peer tutoring is and peer feedback is a crucial aspect of this. I mean, we're fortunate now because we have, you know, Web 2.0. We have access to resources that allow students to interact and write for and write with unknown others around the world. Things like wikis, you know, to collaborate with writers for a wiki forces you to really think about, okay, who are the readers of this, you know, and what do I have to say to make this interesting, you know, even if it's a my hometown kind of website, you know, or you know, foods of China, you know, how to express that in ways that are going to engage a reader, and also demonstrate your competence and the validity of being able to say these things. You know, what makes, you know, why should we listen to you? So these things involve language, and I think, you know, the internet is a great boon. Peer writing, I mean, one of the problem is that obviously peers need, they need some kind of training, they need some kind of input. They need the resources to help each other. Otherwise, it becomes, you know, the blind leading the blind, focusing on surface features because they don't have the knowledge of the rhetorical aspects of writing. So, these aspects are going to be important, and particularly not just in writing, but in terms of peer feedback on writing that's done individually. So, what's got face validity? You know, what has credibility? The teacher's feedback, but to encourage students to trust one another means providing them with the resources that they need to have confidence in each other. There's a lot of research which shows students trust peer comments less than teacher comments, and the teacher is going to be more effective in that area. But as you say, the teacher is one audience, and students often need is practice in either writing for real audiences, you know, letters to the newspaper, writing for on a blog, or writing for general audiences that magazines or whatever. It benefits both parties as well. It benefits the reader as well as the writer, because the reader has some sense of the struggles that the writer has and how that might impact their own writing as well. The issue of peer feedback is particularly interesting here, because the research is positive when peer training is involved, but it's not conclusive on the central issue of whether peer response is an effective means of improving second language written products or even revising strategies. But I read a very good paper some years ago. It's called something like Better to Give Than Receive. And it was an experimental study where one group of students reviewed anonymous papers but received no feedback over a semester, and the receivers received feedback but didn't review the other students' writing. And an analysis of the samples at the beginning and the end of the semester showed that the givers made more significant gains on their own writing than the receivers. So, you know, there's a lot of benefits in students reviewing as readers the work of their peers. I think I've gone off topic there, but
no, that's actually a fascinating finding, and it's directly on topic for me. And also, in a way, it's intuitive if you think about it, because isn't the reader, in a sense, who's in the peer group, who's got the paper of the other person in front of them, let's say, slightly more engaged, because the other person turns them automatically into the student. And I mean, we've all been students. This is nothing against students, but you just don't really pay attention the same way when you're not speaking, right?
yeah, that's right. I mean, interestingly, with this study, they found that the givers at those that gave the feedback at lower proficiency made more gains than at higher proficiency. So, you know, this is not something, you know, to give to your best students. This is something that can benefit students at a lower proficiency level.
One other thing that I've noticed in the use of peer groups is that if the class is also organized as the way that I teach here in Heidelberg, and my listeners will know I'm talking always about my teaching here in Heidelberg. If the course is organized around one-to-one sessions, my experience has been that the students who then go off into the groups of three or four have a sort of model that they're working with, because they're used to working with the, you know, the writing professional in that scenario, and it seems to translate anyway quite well. Mm. Over.
No, that sounds an excellent idea. I don't know. I haven't seen that done. So you're talking about, first of all, group consultations around text, and then one-to-one following that.
Actually, the other way around. So essentially, they're used to already the one-to-one sessions, and then the same group of, say, 12 will then break up into groups of three, and they've all had a week or more of one-to-one sessions with me or any other teacher here. And let's say the technique they've lived through it in a sense. And again, it's inconclusive evidence, as you said, but it's anecdotal, and in this case, I mean, I can only support it.
I guess there's more, there's a greater emphasis on engagement in one-to-one. That the pressure is on the dyad to relate to each other, to understand the text, and to provide useful feedback on it. So in a larger group, students can hide. They don't have the same investment in correcting or commenting on the work. So maybe there's that element. I mean, I think that conferences are useful, these, you know, one-to-one or small group, not just for the alternative readership, but for the fact that peers are actually reading it, you know. So these might be perspectives that matter. You know, you don't really want to make yourself look weak with your mates, but they've found that research, you know, shows that when these things are successful, these oral conferences not only lead to revisions in subsequent drafts, but can go on to have more lasting effects on improving writing in later assignments. You know, this. I think this all involves careful management of the interaction. Particularly if it's done by distance. If it's done online, you've got to minimize threats to the students' face and their self-esteem. Sorry, I'm listening to my phone ringing in the background.
That's a nice song. That's all right.
I know it's a spam call. I just know it. Yeah.
Okay.
The issue with teacher student conferences, of course, is that they consume considerable amounts of time, and require the kinds of interactional skills from both teachers and students that haven't really been fully defined. Perhaps it's a less threatening environment where peers are relating to a text. Students from some cultures particularly in Asia where I've worked, are not always confident in making, in questioning teachers, in challenging their views, in making the most of the opportunities that one-to-one negotiations offer. But with a student, that these interactions become perhaps more, a little bit less threatening, as long as the student has the resources to be able to discuss texts. And I think coming in with a crib sheet of some kind, name two things that you liked about this paper, two things that you think could be improved, you know, what's the main point? Look at how many ideas are in the paper, how were the transitions accomplished, were these successful, you know, so that there is something to focus on rather than simply, you know, circling all the grammar errors.
And I mean, that is, I would say from my own experience anyway, one of the advantages that you get from the one-to-one session, because you've established also, I mean, clearly you can provide these resources, which I think are very much necessary so that the, you know, the student has something to look to when times are tough and they're just sitting across from this paper and they're looking for the or something else in the wrong place. But when as you say also in the book, Second Language Writing, that the teacher needs to be reflective. And this for me was one of the brilliant moments in the book, and it just comes back again and again throughout it, because I realized that, yeah, that's what makes a good teacher, not just in writing generally, but definitely in writing. And I think if there's a reflective teacher teaching that way, it can encourage reflection also in the students or in the learners. And in a, you know, writers group scenario, that's precisely what you need, is people who are just thinking about thinking on writing, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, good teachers come in all shapes and sizes. It's, you know, it's a question of rapport with students, your attitudes to learning, your flexibility in class, a kind of sense of achievement when it goes well. You know, it's a laundry list, the skill set. But I think reflection comes at the top because it requires continual professional development. It requires a teacher to be aware of the options available to do what they can. In the best way that they can do it, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot of research out there. It's daunting to, you know, to have 12 hours of classes a week and then go home and read the literature. I mean, I think teachers have different interests. You know, some want to know, explore how the impact that certain approaches might have on their teaching. Others are interested in the actual texts that students have to write. How can they learn more about those, and how can they help students to come to terms with them and express themselves better in those genres? So, you know, and I think this is continual action research, really. You know, how if I, you know, why did that work? Why didn't that work? What could I do differently in this situation next time? So when, you know, after a class or after a course, teachers getting together, discussing, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, how the course could be improved, what things worked. Observation, not observation for appraisal, but observation to learn. Go into your colleague's class. How does it, you know, what's that person doing differently to what you're doing? Going to conferences, you know, little things, little changes in the classroom, you know, less, giving them more time to write an introduction, or structuring, I don't know, just doing grammar exercises of structures that might be or will be useful in a particular part of a report or a narrative, for example. So, you know, is this going to make a difference? So reflection is important, but it need, you know, reflection on what you're doing informed by the options that are available. So that means reading, talking to colleagues, finding out about your discipline. And I think, you know, we all get exhausted. We go home after a day's work and, you know, we put on NCIS or whatever, you know, we don't want to engage with work anymore. But it doesn't need to be a 24-hour a day reflection. It's really an attitude to teaching. How can I learn from this experience?
And I think you encourage that wonderfully. And this is, again, for me, besides the reflection point, another one of the unique things in the book is that, I mean, there's an entire chapter dedicated to teachers researching. Now, this isn't something that's, you know, on the front page of most teachers' manuals, and yet it just dovetails so perfectly with the idea of being reflective. And you talk about all levels of research, whether or not it's a, you know, a small gathering of data, or if it's a theoretical study, whatever the interests or the needs of the teacher happen to be. But it certainly is a huge encouragement to teaching, and in the area of writing itself in particular, where we're talking about a field that is, I would say, still after all these decades, still in a lot of ways discovering itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone can make a contribution.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's always been this dichotomy, hasn't there, between ivory tower research, which is the practice of experts who work in universities and you know, wear gowns and flat caps, and there's the teaching, which is a practical, hands-on everyday activity. And I think the idea of reflection or research tries to bring those things together. And if it does seem daunting to do research, then enlist colleagues, you know, do something together. And research doesn't need money. It generally needs a bit of time, but you don't need to, hire expensive equipment or research assistants or whatever. You can just explore things. There's so much on the internet. Corpora. I mean, I think a lot of teachers get daunted by, you know, corpora. What can I do with this? Well, you can collect, you know, instead of giving your students' assignments back to them with corrections at the end of the week, you can collect them together as a corpus and go through them, or get the students to interrogate the corpus, looking for particular forms, or asking them questions about, all right, how did, you know, what are common transition words? What is what verbs are used to talk about citing? You know, what can you say instead of say? So there's, you know, research can be very simple, but it's always informative, and actually with something like a corpus, you always learn something new when you look at a corpus, whether it's a student corpus or an expert corpus. And there are plenty of corpora. The COCA corpus, it's free, it's massive, categorized by genre. You can compare different genres, the use of words or phrases in different genres, and it's all available there. I mean, and the internet is a corpus that can be searched. I mean, the possibilities are endless, but also with teaching, you know, what difference does it make if I if I wait an extra 30 seconds before getting a response to a question about that I've asked about a text. You know, the research can be as complex or as simple as you want to, you know, the time you want to give it, but it's generally gives you something back.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, while you were just speaking there and talked about the corpus, it just got me thinking, the corpus is the way, isn't it, that the texts, you know, the functions and the structures that you said were, let's say, an earlier stage as to how writing was taught, sort of return inside of genre teaching, isn't it? It's one of those ways that we can, let's say, as objectively as possible, see, well, what is the language that this community uses, and focus very, very clearly on the language in a way that, you know, people from the 1970s also would have understood, but with tools that, you know, would have blown their minds.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you don't want to turn your engineers into discourse analysts, you know, and they wouldn't thank you for it. But everybody has some interest in writing, particularly if it's their own writing or the text that they are expected to write well. And so some investigation of those texts. So at Hong Kong U, we had a corpus of PhD dissertations, good ones, from all 10 faculties in the university. And students were taught and encouraged to interrogate them. So with worksheets, they can be asked to look at a corpus of a genre that they have to write in their own discipline, and how do writers in that field express limitations or significance, or, you know, how do they criticize, you know, and these things, you know, these are great. Other teachers have asked students to collect corpora of their own work. So they collect corpus of their own writing and then analyze it to see how, well, perhaps compare it with you know, very proficient expert text in that genre, in that field. So there's a lot that can be done. I mean, even if a teacher is using a corpus to inform themselves about, you know, hedging or boosting or citations or the use of I or whatever, it's there. And now we have grammars and dictionaries based on corpora. So the information that we have about language in different genres is enormous.
And the corpus is probably one of those tools that, as you'll know, if you're doing a writing in the disciplines program, and this is a sort of a perennial challenge for teachers in that sort of work, they're not in their subject field. Yeah, so if I'm over in chemistry or biology, I studied English literature. And what I've noticed is that the corpus does give you some reassurance, because you're able then to understand, well, how is it that they speak? For instance, one of my one particular method I use to raise their awareness for what you can do with online journals, which are themselves, in a sense, corpora, is, well, okay, well, who are my readers? If I'm going to be publishing in this or that journal, who are my readers? And I generally say, okay, well, find your key terms, collect some 5 to 10, search the journal for it and see, well, what aspects of those in this particular journal are being covered. Now you start to have a feel for, how do I begin my introduction? Because you're seeing, well, what is interesting to this journal, to this readership, in whatever the subject might be. And you can read their introductions and see, well, where do they begin? Because this is, you know, in biology, for instance, one of those things, well, where do I start?
Well, that's right. And I mean, I don't think we should underestimate the analytical skills of our students. I mean, they're coming very often from disciplines where, you know, an analysis is the main part of what they do, and turning that to language, they're not coming as total beginners here. They have analytical skills. They know how to categorize. They know how to identify. But the idea of you know different audiences is interesting, and we've been doing research recently comparing dissertations with 3-minute theses, the presentation of a thesis in 3 minutes, that it's a competition around the world, and looking at the same writers transforming their published research articles into published blogs for a different audience. So there's a different purpose and a different audience, but the same material. And this can help, I think, help students see the importance of these things. I mean, I'm a big fan of contrasts, you know, whether it's looking at how something is done in an L1 or an L2, comparing textbook advice with what experts actually do, comparing, as I say, these different texts about the same thing for different audiences. All these comparisons are really eye-opening for students and for me. I think it's a real thrill to see how people try and communicate. It really is.
Yeah, and I want to thank you, Ken. You've been very generous with your time. I would like to bring us one more question, though, and that brings us back also to the title of the book, Second Language Writing. You've mentioned L1, L2 a few times, and for listeners, of course, that is the language that you're using as your first language, or second, or third, and so on, depending on how lucky you've been in your life and how many languages you've been able to learn. But I suppose the question is why not just writing? So what is it that's so distinct? What is it that's so distinctive about the second and first language writer? If I might just throw one more prompt in there, I've heard plenty of talk about the idea that whichever language you happen to learn writing in, you've learned writing, and that skill transfers across languages better than the other way around. Having learned a language and then another language and then from one to the other trying to become a better writer.
Yeah, this is, I mean, that's a really difficult question to end on.
Very sorry about that.
No, I mean, I think there's enough evidence around now to persuade us that writers differ in some of their culturally influenced writing practices, and that these differences show up in preferences for particular text features, for ways of structuring arguments. We have different, I think culture is often a dirty word for some people. They'd prefer the world to be sort of blandly homogenous, you know, the McDonaldization of the world. But there are different cultural schemata. The intercultural rhetoric ideas of Ulla Connor and so forth, that that people come to an act of writing with different assumptions about what they're trying to do. They have different ways of doing it. There's nothing to say that that second language writers can't write in a second language as well as first language writers can, but there is a difference in terms, I think, of how people approach text. I mean, there's differences in conceptions about what knowledge is, about what writing is, about how we learn, about how, you know, what the teacher should be doing to improve my writing. So different expectations. Love and Wenger talk about situated cognition. So learning is tied closely to culture. And I think writing is also tied closely to culture. So setting and activity are inseparable to learning how to write. And we might be making a mistake if we think that all writing is the same and expect that our students' prior experiences of writing have prepared them for our classroom practices. I mean, there's a lot of different scripts out there, for example. There's texts are valued in different ways. Different kinds of argument structures are prioritized. Doesn't mean that these different ways of writing are exclude people who write in another way. They're available to everybody, but we have preferences, I think. Also, of course, whether L1 and L2 writing is the same depends on what writing is going on. I don't think writing is a single thing. It's done, as I've been saying, to achieve purposes, and these differ by situation and in response to a particular context. So, the conventions of a particular community expects are going to be different. But the idea of L1 and L2 is not entirely useful in some ways. I think we've tended to see second language writing as a thing. It must exist because as something separate to L1 writing, because there's a whole industry surrounding it. It's a social fact created by the weight of theses, books, conferences, journal articles, and so on. So it's kind of, all this is reified second language writing, so we take it for granted. But it does put up this dichotomous framing which opposes first and second language writers, treats what they write as more or less unproblematically writing. I see the point you're making. But the idea of second language writing is reassuring in some ways. It provides us with a sense that we're dealing with something that's tangible and manageable. Okay, so this is a bounded category of events that we can treat in certain ways using, our tried and trusted methodologies. But who are the first language writers that these are opposed to? What is it that they're writing? I think our second language writers in the literature are almost always non-native English speakers, and what they're writing is generally some kind of high stakes academic or professional English of some kind. But the differences between this group of L2 writers is probably greater than their similarities. They come from different proficiencies, learning backgrounds, prior teaching experiences, different motivations, expectations, target needs. They have different disciplines, gender, social class. So there's this rich diversity of backgrounds and experiences and understandings is kind of smoothed out by an understanding of second language writing. I'm not saying that student second language writing doesn't exist. It's a useful tool. It's also helped us to focus on what L1 writing is, looking at the conventions, the options and choices available to writers, to the impact of community and social purpose on writing. So this is a really hard question, isn't it? I mean,
it very much is. And I probably shouldn't have saved it to last, but it's so intriguing. I would just like to give it a minute more, because what you're saying is making me really think about, I do not throw into doubt the idea of second language writing or first language writing. I agree with you entirely that we're dealing with terminology that's useful, but terminology that can also be safe in a way that might not actually get us thinking. So, there's both of these these things going on here for sure. But I suppose what comes to my mind is when you describe the second language writers as such a diverse group, it's just as easy to turn around in say a country like America to say the same about the first language writers and the diversity that's represented there. And I wonder if sometimes second language writing isn't, let's say, identifying itself too closely with language learning. And not putting, you know, it should be writing in a second language. Put something up front that's really happening. And because the language itself matters amongst so many other variables, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think one thing that an emphasis on second language writing has given us is the recognition that writing is important. You know, I don't think there's a university anywhere now that doesn't have a writing center or some kind of at least an office where students can go and get consultation about their texts. It's become important, and it's become important in native English speaking contexts as well, and in UK universities. And in fact, when we look at writing, I mean, I think this kind of emphasizes what you're saying. When we look at writing at advanced levels like PhDs or writing for publication, you know, language doesn't really come into it anymore. It's a rhetorical issue. And this crude native, non-native polarization, I think, breaks down entirely. You know, it's counterproductive because it demoralizes second language writers who are trying to get their PhD or publish in journals, and it ignores the very real writing problems experienced by native English speakers, by L1s. You know, so the L1s get ignored in favor of the L2s who get the courses, but everybody's unhappy because it's seen as a language issue rather than, as you say, a writing issue. But native English speakers don't have an advantage when it comes to writing. They don't acquire writing naturalistically at their mother's knee like speaking. They've got to invest time, effort, money, formally learning to write, and they experience, you know, the kind of difficulties that L2 writers have. So, I mean, my mother was a hospital cleaner for most of her life. She could not write, you know, a paragraph, let alone a paper for publication, you know, any more than she could fly to the moon. So, you know, this dichotomy doesn't really work when we're thinking about writing at these levels where we're putting our work out for general consumption with critical peers.
Well, thank you very much. That is Ken Hyland, and his book Second Language Writing is out in a second edition with Cambridge University Press in 2019. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to Ken. Goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye, Daniel. Goodbye, everyone.
And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.